Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey there, and welcome to episode 43 of Kneel Before Odd. I'm Audrey Kearns, and this is a podcast where I like to say I interview geek patriots. And I've got a good one for you today. The interview you're about to hear is with writer Daniel Corey. Corey is a scribe behind some wonderful comics, including Moriarty, Red City, and most recently Bloodworth, all of which are incredibly smart, witty, and dabble in science fiction, which, as you know, I love. So you guys should definitely check those out. Once again, Moriarty, Red City, and Bloodworth. And of course, we're going to be talking about those in this interview. Now, I knew Dan in the 90s, the 90s people. We were both working at Universal Studios in Orlando, and we often worked together, but we never really knew each other very well. And my husband and I moved out to LA in 2002, and flash forward to now, and Dan and I have reconnected by chance out here in Los Angeles. Now, he's this prolific writer, and I'm running Geek Girl Authority. Things have changed so much in our lives, and it was super fun catching up with Dan while doing an interview. I think that you'll definitely feel that energy as you listen to it as well. I urge you to check out Dan's Kickstarter for his latest project called Bloodworth. I read the first issue, and it's certainly worthy of your support. The Kickstarter will enable Daniel Corey's team to work on issue 2 and have the folks that work so hard on getting the issue completed paid. There's more on the world of Bloodworth in the interview, and I'm sure you're going to find that as fascinating as I did. And one last thing. Before I start, please check out geekgirlauthority.com. It will satisfy all your pop culture and geek culture needs with breaking news, trailers, wonderful guest articles, and podcasts. Check out GGA's Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram as well. And while you're at it, you should find me there as well, at Audrey Kearns, K-E-A-R-N-S, in the social media world. So that's it. Enjoy yourselves, guys. Enjoy episode 43 of Kneel Before Odd with writer Daniel Corey.
Internet, heed this call. Open your minds and ears and prepare yourselves to kneel before Odd.
Welcome to episode 43 of Kneel Before Odd. I'm Audrey Kearns, and this is the podcast where I interview geek patriots. And my guest today is writer Daniel Corey. Daniel is a writer behind the graphic novels Prophet, Image Comics Moriarty, and Red City. And he's also behind the comic Bloodworth, which is currently running a Kickstarter campaign, which we're going to talk about soon. And hello, Dan. How's it going?
Hello. Wow. That was a heck of an intro.
Thank you. Well, you deserve it.
Oh, thank you.
You're very deserving. Thanks for coming over to my house.
It's lovely. I'm going to be transfixed on your bookcase here. You got so many wonderful things.
We are recording in the nerd room.
Yeah. We got some Doctor Who. We got some Star Trek. We got a little everything.
Did you know this? Because I do, and I talk about this often. I do have obsessive compulsive disorder.
Oh, really?
But did you notice that it? Like each shelf, there's no mixing of the genres.
So
there's Star Trek, and then you got your Doctor. They won't mix.
Yeah, well, I would think that's fair.
That's normal, right?
Though. Yeah, it totally is. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were talking before we started recording, we still have some empty shelves here that I just have basket placeholders in. So there's plenty of room to grow.
Yeah.
I just need the money to buy all the geeky stuff. Do you have a nerd room or anything, some shelves or in your office or anything?
I have an office, but it's a disaster with boxes of comics,
copies of comics,
you know? Uh-huh. But I have some stuff. I have a few statues, a few things I'm proud of. I am friends with Jerry Macaluso at Pop Culture Shock Toys. And, I got a David Matt Kabuki statue from him. It's like a 1/3, size statue. I have that on my desk next to my computer. Nice. I'm particularly proud of that. That's really
That's
beautiful.
Your prize possession right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I love that series. I love David's work, and I just love that they made such a nice statue of it. So
cool. Well, you know, the first question I ask all my guests is, what is your nerd origin story? So, Daniel Corey, what is your nerd origin story?
Oh, man, we're starting with that.
We're going to start. Yeah. We go right into it, my friend.
Man, this is heavy stuff. No, Let's not really. I think I'm...
Are we going to do some psychoanalysis right now?
Oh, well, there's... yeah, actually.
Let's do it.
Okay. No, but I mean, it's a fairly standard thing. It's not anything odd or off the wall. But, okay, Superman the movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Superman the movie.
Christopher Reeve Superman.
Christopher Reeve, yeah. So... that was...
How old were you around?
You know, when they showed it on television, I was 4.
Okay.
So I think it was 77 it came out or 78?
Yes, it's one of those. It's, I know
was
it's
it
late 70s.
Star Wars?
Yeah. I thought it was after. We're going to be doing
Is
some
it
fact
after?
Checking.
Okay. We'll have to do that. Okay. I should have looked it up before I came here, but it's probably 78 maybe. But so it was about 79 when I saw it because I was 4.
Mm-hmm.
And now the whole world knows how old I am. That's okay. That's
well,
okay.
Well, I saw it in a theater, so now the world knows how old I am.
But I mean, I saw Star Wars in the theater. I was 3. You know, that was my first movie.
Star Wars was?
Yeah. But and that was a big deal too. But you know, I have memories of that. I think, but I don't know if I just dreamt it or what. But you know, because I was so little. But
yeah.
My mom tells me of my time at Star Wars. She said that I was standing up on the seat, transfixed the whole time.
You were that's so adorable.
Yeah.
I love it.
So
I think so many people of our generation, because I am older than you, but I don't think by much if you're saying you're 4 in 1977, just had that experience of being absolutely hypnotized by Star Wars in the theaters, and it was great.
Yeah, because
it was a wonderful feeling.
It was such a first time thing, and we were small children, and you know, but the thing that I really remember better though is Superman the movie, and so I didn't see it in the theater because I think I was 2 or 3 when that came out, but I watched it. ABC showed it over 2 nights.
They split it up into two. Oh God, I remember back then.
Yeah, it was. It was a Sunday night and a Monday
1978.
Night.
1978. I had to look it up.
78? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, okay.
So, that was a good year, huh?
That was a great year.
But they split up over 2 nights. It was a Sunday night and a Monday night. And I didn't know until later that because some of the scenes weren't in the theatrical version because they padded it out in the miniseries, I guess, format there.
Oh.
So when I would watch it as a through just a standalone film later on, there was stuff I thought I remembered him going through the tunnel and deflecting the bullets off his chest when he was getting to Lex Luthor's lair. But I think that was not in the theatrical version.
Interesting.
But when they released it on Blu-ray later, they put all that stuff in.
Never caught that.
Yeah, it's crazy the format of that the structure of that movie just was fluid over the years, it seemed. But when I saw it, I was 4. It was on TV. It was on ABC. It was 2 nights, and I remember seeing the ads for it. My parents were so I was a Superman fanatic. My parents were like, "You gonna watch Superman, right, Daniel? You gonna watch Superman on TV?" And I was nervous. I was scared because I didn't know how they were gonna treat him.
Interesting. You know? So you already knew about Superman, and were you reading comics at this time, or
just like Super Friends and coloring books,
cartoons
and I had a cape and toys. So I was well acclimated to Superman, but
it's so interesting that like I think I went to the movie knowing already that he was going to be a hero, but you were kind of worried about what his journey was going to be.
Yeah, I didn't know how they were going to represent him. I was like, were they going to make him weak? Was I going to see him get hurt?
You're already thinking that way at 4.
Yeah.
Of course you're a writer.
I was really worried about it. I was scared. I was nervous. And I was 4, you know. And then I remember that Sunday. So we're at church and my family friend, Mr. Westmoreland, I remember, he comes up to me all excited. He goes, Daniel, you going to watch Superman tonight? And he seemed so excited about it, and this is an outsider's perspective on it. And suddenly, plus I'm 4 and I have no willpower. It just, in my mind, a switch flipped, And I say, yeah. And my parents like look at each other like, what the heck's wrong with this kid? He's got willpower, you know? And like, I thought you didn't want it. And I was just, I don't know. It just, you know, of course I couldn't explain it. You
right,
know,
right.
As I look at it now as an adult, I reasoned out. It's like, oh, it suddenly just seemed like a good idea.
Right,
because
right.
It just, you know, I got convinced. But anyways, I watched it and it, you know, the movie, having watched it so early and it was so formative time of me, for me, that it had a lot to do with the person I became. Because I saw this nice. Movie about this guy, because he's a hero and, you know, he walks this path of he's a lonely mm-hmm. person, you know, because mm-hmm. he's always doing what's right. And you know, as I mentioned, you know, we went to church growing up, and that was a thing that I learned as a kid. Is like you got to do the right thing, you got to be good to people, and it's not easy, and people aren't going to like you for it.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to persevere and do the right thing. And here it was in this movie, seeing this guy do exactly that.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, when you think about it also, I mean, he didn't go around punching people and knocking people out. You know, he rescued people mostly. I can't think of
– He wasn't looking for a fight.
Yeah, you know? I can't think of him fighting anybody yeah. in that movie really. You know, he would like rustled up Lex and took him to yeah. jail. But, you know, he didn't beat him up or anything. So yeah. he wasn't a violent guy. He was a hero. He put himself on the line. He walked this lonely path. And he did what was right despite everything. And that, you know, that taught me about – you know, the value of integrity,
mm-hmm.
you know, the value of justice, doing what's right. And, you know, it reinforced everything I learned from my parents and
right.
Sunday school and all that, you know.
It's a great tale.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you look back at it now and you have a different connection to it than I do. And sometimes, you know, it looks, it's a bit cartoonish and mm-hmm. and stuff like that, but I still love it. Mm-hmm. I have to say that.
Yeah.
But I do remember being absolutely mesmerized when I was a child mm-hmm. watching that movie, being
yeah.
completely wrapped up into it. In fact, I was super scared in the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of my nightmares was and you'll have to, I can't think of it. The what's the mirror thing they put Zod in?
Oh, the Phantom Zone.
The Phantom Zone. That freaked me out.
Oh,
and that special effect.
You had nightmares about that going in there?
About that special effect. It was so scary.
It's hell, basically.
Yeah, when it was spinning in space and you just saw them screaming. And hence my name on my podcast, Neil Before Odd.
Yeah, absolutely, of course.
But yeah, I really like that one. I love that. Did you actually get more into comics after you saw Superman? Or were you already on that path?
You know, I got the superheroes mainly through, through TV and films and, through the toys and, I didn't become like a hardcore comics reader. When I became a preteen,
mm-hmm.
You know, when I got to be about like 9, 10 or whatever like that, I got really into military heroes and G.I. Joe and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I really got into the Marvel G.I. Joe series and I read the Transformers stuff. So the Hasbro, uh-huh. All that stuff. That's when I really got into comics. And, I didn't regularly pick up the superhero books just because I had my own way of relating to the superheroes through the other media.
Of course, that was the wonderful thing about them is that there is a lot of media. Now, I want to say full disclosure
mm-hmm.
that Dan and I met in the 90s.
Yeah,
for my listeners. Yeah, this is so bizarre that we're actually
another
sitting down.
Another century,
man. It's like, Oh, we're aging. I'm aging us again.
It's okay.
We were both hustling in Orlando, and when I met you, it was we were actors at Universal Studios.
Yes.
And gosh, that was so long ago. Are you from Florida?
Yeah.
We worked together, Florida. But we weren't super close or anything like that. We were just acquaintances at that time. So you did. Where in Florida are you from?
From Orlando, right there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I grew up in the Cocoa area.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then moved to Orlando with school in Gainesville. And then
oh, really? Okay. Yeah, I was in Orlando the whole time.
The whole time,
until we moved to California.
What got you into acting?
Wow. It's, you know, I had... done it since I did my first like play in high school,
uh-huh.
you know, I had just always been into music. I mean, like as a little kid, I was in band. I played saxophone. I took piano lessons and all that sort of thing. And my parents really encouraged me to be involved in the arts. Mm-hmm. You know, I played sports like all the regular normal kids too. Right. But I was really into the arts. And gosh, I can't remember. You know, I got involved in the theater program at my school. And in high school, and it's like they had just started it up, and they made an announcement. Anybody that wants to be involved in the theater program, you know, have there's a meeting at lunch, and that just seemed natural to me to do that because it's like, right. Oh, I love music, I love performing, uh-huh. I should be in a play, uh-huh. You know. So that's how I guess that
so
how
one
it started.
Thing that kind of led to just
it was just opportunities, yeah. That's opportunities.
I love that. You know, being in one place at one time can lead to choices in your life because mm-hmm. being in that creative life as an actor obviously had an influence on mm-hmm. on your path mm-hmm. and everything.
Absolutely.
So I moved out here in 2002. When did you move out here?
Gosh, it was 2003.
Okay, because I don't know if you remember this, but I mm-hmm. remember I was working. Do you remember running into me?
Yeah, in Santa Monica.
Yeah, okay.
At the coffee shop.
Yeah. And I just remember... We meet again.
Yeah.
Hadn't seen each other in years and years. And so still hustling. I just remember clearly, like I was so sweaty. It was in like this non-air conditioned cafe and just turning around and seeing Dan, who I knew in Florida, and just having that, like it was probably just a second, but it seemed like a lot of seconds.
You were out of time for a moment there.
Are you really here?
Yeah.
What's going on? And we were both, we're just... Mm-hmm. working to pay our rent, and mm-hmm. which we still are.
But it was, we're doing better now.
But that was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then when was the next time we ran into each other? I think it was like at a con or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we started meeting up at cons, and there was a time, the first time I saw the two of you guys, you and Brian together, was I was working recruiting for test screenings.
Yes, on the promenade.
Yeah, on the promenade.
I do remember
that. Was during like the farmer's market in Santa Monica. Yeah. And that was the first time I saw Brian, and that was the first time I saw the two of you guys. And that was probably 2004 or 2005.
Because you used to work directly with Brian, my husband, mm-hmm. as an actor at Universal.
Yeah.
Gosh, wow. Time.
Yeah.
Time flies. So then I run into you at cons and everything, and you're a writer, which I think you mm-hmm. probably always were. I just didn't know mm-hmm. that about you. When did your focus, so you come out here to Los Angeles, when did you really realize that your focus was going to be on writing?
It was when I decided to start creating comics. Mm-hmm. It just took up all my time, and I really got into the idea of content creation.
Was that a slow burn, or was it like a flash of lightning? This is what I'm going to do.
It was a bit of a slow burn, but it wasn't it wasn't years. It was maybe a year. You know,
right.
I never really made a conscious decision. I'm not going to act anymore. It was just the other thing took over. I'd still like to get back to acting at some point. I just haven't had the time.
Right.
But,
I feel you on that one.
Yeah. But it was when I got into creating the comics that just – I got into this idea of I really wanted to create my own intellectual property and mm-hmm. kind of control it and kind of – you know, I like this idea of having my own fiefdom of properties,
like
you know.
That.
And
I like that.
Yeah. And so, you know, I spent the last several years and I do have a little stable of properties of my own.
You
and
do.
Some mm-hmm. of them have made it into the public sphere and published as books. And so I'm mm-hmm. very happy about that.
That's amazing. Was the first – one that you worked on as far as getting out into the public, was that Profit?
Yeah. And I call it, my company's called Danger Cat.
Yes.
So these days I call it Danger Cat's Profit.
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't get confused with the other one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Got it.
But just so I don't get in trouble with anybody as we talk here.
No, totally.
I met Anthony Diachidue is the artist that I worked with on that.
I was so waiting for you to pronounce his name.
Oh,
that's
why
I didn't bring it up.
Yeah,
I was like, I don't know how to pronounce it last name.
Well, you can just call him Anthony from here on out. I'll handle the last name duties for you.
Perfect.
But he's Italian. His name translates into 10-2 Diachidue. He and his wife got married October 2nd.
Now never forget how to. Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so.
How clever. Yeah,
10-2. But I met him through a neighbor. My neighbor Mario is a wonderful artist. He's mm-hmm. he's a fine artist painter, and he didn't do comics or storyboards or anything like that. But I was asking him, I wanted to meet somebody. So he introduced me to Anthony. They worked at Universal here.
Oh, wow.
They were caricature artists.
Oh, wow.
And so he introduced me to Anthony, and we actually he did some panels for me. I created an animatic for a script that I was pitching at the time. And then after that, we rolled into doing the Profit Project together, and I formed my company Danger Cat. Basically just as a clearinghouse for all my creative projects,
if you guys want to check out, that's DANGERKATT.
Yeah. All one word. Yeah.
All one word.
Yeah. .com. All one word. DangerCat.com. But yeah, I created the company basically to just house my projects, whatever the form they're going to take. So primarily I do comics, you know, but I write my own spec screenplays and, you know, I haven't worked in a theater for a while, but I was writing plays and we were doing small workshop productions of plays. I was doing that in Florida when I knew you guys, and we did a little bit of that here too. That's another thing I'd like to get back to, some work in the theater, man.
Yes.
But
feel the same way, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm so consumed with running Geek Girl Authority and doing these.
I can't imagine the amount of work you have to do daily.
But I miss being on stage. I miss writing for the stage. It's a passion. I think that I'm sure you feel this way, that you will return to one day and do it again. It doesn't go away.
Yeah, it's a very singular and special thing. Yeah.
Why?
On stage.
Why Danger Cat?
I'm a cat lover. Uh-huh. We have two cats right now. We had two when I started the company, and then we picked up a third one, and then we had one pass away last year. But anyways, at some point for a handful of years, we had three cats in our small apartment, you know, so we just – and we still feel inundated with cats, you know, but we
but
love
that's
cats.
Awesome. Yeah. I love cats.
Yeah, we love cats. And I'm like – I love cats. I want to come up with a cool cat related name, and I just came up with Danger Cat.
I love
it.
It's very catchy. It's very memorable too. You can really remember it. And I love your logo.
Yeah, Brenda's my wife. Brenda Brenda's idea. I was coming up with ideas for a logo, and she's like, "Why not do a biohazard symbol with a cat's head in the middle of it?" And it was that easy. And I asked Anthony to do that for me. And he did it in a couple of days. And it just was really simple and elegant and very beautiful and very cool looking, the logo he came up with. So I was very happy that that came together.
I love these little things about life, though, that like you said, your neighbor, Mario, introduced you to Anthony.
Yeah.
And here it is all this time later. And you guys have been working together.
Yeah.
All this time.
It's crazy.
I love that. And it's just because of some chance meeting or,
And there's another guy, Alex Aquino. Mm-hmm. I always like to plug him because he helped me out when he's a businessman now. He owns a chain of clothing stores called Barnabas Clothing. And he's got a couple of locations here in Southern California. I'd recommend go checking it out, Barnabas Clothing. I'll give him a good plug there.
There you go.
Alex is a ace businessman, and I had lunch with him one afternoon. And he just gave me the basics on registering with the city, getting a tax ID number, just ran all that down with me, and it just changed my life. All that basic information. I was able to start my company, and then through Mario, met Anthony, and I had a lunch meeting with Jim Kruger once, and Jim is a great comic writer, Eisner winning writer, and he did the amazing the books for Image and DC, like he did Justice with Alex Ross for DC. He's done a lot of wonderful work. You know, when I was first putting together Profit with Anthony, I had a lunch with Jim, and he just ran down some very basic stuff with me on how to get started doing a comic, and that changed my life too, you know?
That's a wonderful thing, you know, because LA, LA, as you know, as anybody who lives here knows, it can be a hard city, and I think it can be very frightening for people, but the truth is there are really good people here, and like the people that you meet and that you choose to surround yourself with. It's amazing the symbiotic relationship that you can have with them and how everybody can help each other out. You know, me and my creative friends, we will drop anything to help someone out or give advice. You know, like, one of my friends, you know, Jenna Bush, who runs Legion She's of great. Leia. We met. We both started our websites on, you know, May the 4th be with you, 2014. And we never stopped like helping each other, even though we have two nerd sites that are up and running. We are constantly texting each other, calling each other, helping each other out. There's no competition, you know.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, and I think that's actually the secret to success, is not harboring any kind of like, oh my God, I gotta get up before anybody else.
Right. I mean, I remember hearing David Crosby telling a story once about how that crew of people, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and then there was Neil Young, and then there was I think Carole King, and all those musicians were all working at the same time. They went and played on everybody's albums, and they never were compensated. He's like, all the time we would go into studio and play on their album. They'd come play on our album, and there was never any compensation.
And look at their careers and their effect on the world, empire of music.
Yeah. You know, so
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, I want to talk about some of your books.
Okay.
So I'm getting excited because I really like Moriarty.
Oh, thanks.
And we all know Professor James Moriarty from, from Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Yeah, exactly right. when I first started putting out the title, that's where everybody knew him from. It was hilarious.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, do you mean that you met some people that didn't know that he was from Sherlock Holmes?
I met a lot of people.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. All right. But if you watch Star Trek, then you would know he's from, right? Well, maybe they forgot.
A lot of people didn't put it together. They just forgot. Yeah.
So he is from Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes.
Absolutely.
And he's only mentioned in a few, right?
Yeah, a handful of stories.
Yes, but he is, you know, the conniving, super smart, maybe smarter than Sherlock Holmes, responsible for killing Sherlock Holmes before he was brought back.
Before he came back to life,
and everything. And so you've taken this villain, this incredibly smart villain, and made him a main character of a series. So tell me about how that came about.
Well, so Anthony and I had put together the Danger Cat's Prophet book, and that was a couple of years, about 3 years of hard work, I think, probably. That was finally out in trade paperback, and it was right before the digital thing came about, so it took a few years later to get on Comixology, but now it's officially available everywhere.
Prophet is on Comixology?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Just look it up under D for Danger Cat's Prophet.
Danger Cat's Prophet.
Yeah. But anyway, so we had finished that, and I was trying to figure out what to do next, and the idea had just came to me one day. You know, I always think of Jack Nicholson as the Joker in the 1989 Batman. And it's like, I was in the bath one day and I realized why I was destined for greatness, because I came up with the idea in the shower. I was actually in the shower, just letting my mind wander through creative like possibilities. What should I do next?
Nice. And
it just suddenly really came to me. Nobody's done a Moriarty comic book that I know of.
And you are a fan of Doyle's books. You've already been a fan.
Since a child, you know, the Basil Rathbone films got me into it. Because they would show those like on the local ABC affiliate on Sunday afternoons. And I would always watch those on the afternoon after church. And I was just fascinated by this character. And then I remember my mom went to like a library sale and brought me home a little hardback book that collected some of the adventures of Sherlock Holmes stories. And I started reading. And I eventually got this tome that collected everything. And I would take that with me and read it. So I was a fan of the stories. And somehow my mind wrapped into just started thinking about the Sherlock Holmes world, and basically it just came to me, Professor Moriarty. I don't know that I've seen him as a lead character in anything.
Right.
It had been done in some novels, but it had never been done in a film, and it had never been done in a comic book as far as him being the title character, being leading man. I'm thinking in 100 years of Sherlock Holmes adaptations, there's never been a Professor Moriarty comic book.
Yet if somebody was to say who are the top five villains in literature, Moriarty would be the person that comes up.
And it's like, why hasn't this been done?
So in your Moriarty, it's been 20 years since Holmes died. He's changed his name, his life, and he's kind of like, like a lord of the criminal underworld. He finds out that Mycroft Holmes is missing and... You know, there starts the tale of suspense, and I love there's like a supernatural element into it, and it's very, very layered and complex. How long? So for your process, I mean, how long did you work on that story before you talked to Anthony or before you talked to anybody else?
I actually first started talking it up to Anthony right about when I was first outlining it,
When you're up right after your shower.
Yeah, exactly right. I got out of the shower. I got right out of the shower. I went right to my computer and I wrote a five line
smart
paragraph.
Yes.
And that was my statement thesis of Professor Moriarty. And the basic premise completely went out the window. But just the idea of
doing
that.
But that's how you started. I mean, that's the great thing about writing is you've got to be willing to throw stuff away.
And I threw a lot away when I was developing that. And I actually spent 2 years working on the script for that first story because it was so hard. And it overlapped with Prophet. So I guess we were still kind of wrapping up Prophet. Mm-hmm. And I was talking it up to Anthony, but then I was working on the script. It's kind of hazy how it all kind of overlapped, but I spent 2 years writing that first story because it was very difficult to come up with just the rules of the world, what right. I wanted to do with him,
right?
All this, you know, it was World War I, there was espionage. I mean, there's a ninja in it,
yes,
which is actually one of the very first thing. That was probably the first idea after I came up with Professor Moriarty as a leading man in a comic book. I thought, ninja. Oh, the leading lady's going to be a ninja.
Of course. Why
he's going to have a Japanese yeah. woman who's a ninja warrior that mm-hmm. he works with mm-hmm. because Sherlock Holmes, oh, ninjas.
Yes.
You think that.
Of course. They go hand in hand.
You know? I mean, there was a lot of that shower steam was in my head at right. that point. And yeah. I don't know why that was.
It gave you some great ideas.
It sure did. I don't know why but that was absolutely the first idea I had was to have her in there. So mm-hmm. it came up with this character named Jade, the Jade Serpent. But, you know, I was like, there's Moriarty. There's a missing Mycroft Holmes. There's British Security Services. There's a ninja.
Oh, yeah, and then Lestrade's in there, too.
Yeah, and trying to bring in characters from the original canon, bringing in people from history,
fun.
People from other books.
That was really
fun. There's a Fagin character
yeah,
in the book.
Yeah, when I got to the Fagin character, I was like, oh, that's so clever. And
yeah.
and now that's a feat in itself. What was it? I mean, I would assume putting together, as hard as it is, putting together that puzzle must have been very fun because, you know, mm-hmm. you have, you know, the assassination of Ferdinand.
Yeah.
And so you have that World War I, like you just talked mm-hmm. about, that history element. So you had to definitely fact check and make sure you had your
lots
history
of history
right.
involved.
And then
yes.
you have, like you said, characters from the canon.
Lots of literature involved.
And you have to weave all that together. And
yeah.
Were there times where you were just like, oh, this is so fun? Or were you always pulling your hair out?
I was pulling my hair out a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, after about the first 6 months, I trashed most of my ideas and started
wow.
from scratch, which it's not something I've ever done since or mm-hmm. before. Mm-hmm. But I had a sense of mission in putting this together because
right.
it just felt very important.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, because like originally the idea had to do with him getting with Moriarty himself getting involved with the Black Hand and going to Serbia and getting involved with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. But then that was too clever. It just seemed like,
yeah.
oh, I'm going to do this and I'm yeah. going to do this. When you're writing a story, you yeah. get into a lot of trouble when you just come up with lots of great ideas mm-hmm. and try to make it happen. And that was not happening for the character because I was putting him in too many places where he was making himself way too obviously vulnerable. And I'm like, I can't.
Were you focusing on being that kind of, but
yeah.
without focusing on building,
without focusing on the character,
yeah.
you know? And that's another thing writers are guilty of all the time is we throw out all the principles and the craft in favor of clever ideas mm-hmm. and clever premises. You
yes,
know?
And they become very sometimes a little too precious.
They become too precious.
Yes.
That's absolutely right.
Right.
So
one of the hardest things, I'm not a prolific writer like you, but I do some writing. And one thing I've done is sometimes I'll write, I know a monologue that's not even going to be in the play I'm writing
mm-hmm.
or something, just so I can get to know the
yeah,
character
absolutely.
A little bit. And that's, when I first started doing that, it was a hard sacrifice for me because it was kind of like a time
mm-hmm.
sacrifice because I just wanted to get everything. I wanted to finish the story, get everything mm-hmm. done. It was like, no, Audrey, you got to put the work into the world and you got to mm-hmm. put the work into the
mm-hmm.
to the people. And you obviously put a lot of work into Moriarty.
Yes.
Do you think is he in your story an anti-hero?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's a complex guy. He's never thought of himself as being evil, and he's
mm-hmm.
not really a villain, you know. He's a really damaged individual, but so much so that he doesn't even know it.
Right.
You know? I don't portray him or think of him as being like a sociopath,
no.
a non-feeling
right.
person.
Right.
I actually had a conversation with an analyst once. It was at a friend's birthday party, and there's a lady there who was who's a psychologist and therapist. And so I treasured this opportunity to be able to talk to the, to, like, I need to talk to you about somebody I know, named Professor Moriarty. Uh-huh. And she's like, it sounds like he's obsessive compulsive. I'm like, well, that's it. He is obsessive compulsive.
Interesting.
Of his viewpoint of the world, of his fixation on homes, mm-hmm. you know. But he's just a guy, and he had a really bad childhood. I don't want to divulge too much of that because I hope to get to it in future editions.
Right.
But he's just got a damaged perspective of the world, and what mm-hmm. he wants to do is put the world back together again in the way that he sees fit.
That he sees it should be.
And it's not with an intent to harm people, but it's just to make things right the way he wants it to be right.
Uh-huh.
And so that way he'll end up helping people, he'll end up rescuing people or helping people because it serves his agenda,
uh-huh.
you know. So he'll do good things.
Yes,
but not because he's good, but he's not actually not that bad either, but it's just so complicated.
It is, and I think it's very complex. It's challenging to the reader in a very good way. I mean, but you set that up nicely because in the beginning of the book you talk about his three rules,
mm-hmm.
you know, the always be victorious and everything like mm-hmm. that. So you can see where some of his actions are very self-serving. He's got an arrogance about him, mm-hmm. but at the same time he's so driven, which mm-hmm. I think I can see with the obsessive compulsive behavior. I mean, he was so driven to find mm-hmm. out what happened to Mycroft and everything.
And he gets himself in trouble with
that obsession. You don't know if he's doing it as a sense of doing something that's right. He just needs he needs to find out. He needs to know.
Yeah, at the end of the day, he's not really sure. He's really kind of empty inside. He doesn't really know exactly what he's going for. He's trying to figure out what he wants.
Yeah.
You know, he just knows he wants something.
Exactly. What a fun character for you to tackle. What a stroke of brilliance you had in the shower.
Oh, thank you.
Shower and that day.
It's interesting that you mentioned like that, how he outlines his three rules of how he lives life. That was my monologue that I wrote for him to get to know the character once I started straightening out the world.
End up starting, like it's already, the assassination's already happened when the book starts. So that's interesting. You threw out all that work, but you still had built the world in your head mm-hmm. a little bit. So you were still able, so it wasn't lost.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about another main character of yours, Cal Talmadge from Red City, which is that graphic novel is so fascinating to me because it's like Mars noir. I mean, those are two of my favorite things. Something that happens on another planet.
Yeah.
And it's noir.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I, it was another project. I worked on that with Anthony. I also met mm-hmm. Chris Finolio, who I'm working on Blood with now.
Uh-huh.
And that was, I got Chris onto that book too. And, I had this idea to do Philip Marlowe on Mars, or LA Confidential on Mars, mm-hmm. you know, something.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
I was, I had a chance to visit Image's office mm-hmm. up in Oakland there, up in Berkeley, rather. And I was talking to Eric Stevenson, and he said, you should do another four-issue mini, and I said, well, I had an idea to do Philip Marlowe on Mars. And he said, that's cool. And that was basically my green light. So like Red
From
City
Image?
Was... So that Red City was going to happen. Now, it took about another 2 years for it to hit the shelves because there was a lot of hard work that happened.
Of course.
But, it was a long, painful process getting everything together to finally get the book released. But it finally happened. You know, I wrote the script for that in about 6 months. You know, I had to... I had everything completely outlined. I had the first issue written when I pitched it to Eric.
Uh-huh.
And then, when he said, okay, then, I was able to go back and finish the other issues and then assemble the team and all that. It took a long time, but we hit the shelves and, it was LA Confidential on Mars. You know, I had this idea to kind of create something that would be a little bit like the Federation. I guess you could compare it to where, the entire solar system, as we know it, has always been populated by life forms. You know, uh-huh. So it's kind of a Ray Bradbury science fiction reality where there's different alien races on every planet. And we've just always kind of known that and accept that. But we're in the distant future and everybody, all the planets, and Pluto is a planet again. I made sure to make a statement of that. I think that's on page 4.
So Neil deGrasse Tyson isn't in the picture anymore.
And it's like 500 years after him. So so we're like way in the future, and yeah, so all of the solar system is operating as like one country, or trying to, and they call it the NSS, the New Solar System, and that's kind of the name of this country, and each planet is its own like city state,
right?
You know,
got it.
And they've recently come out of this war where a couple of planets have tried to secede, so it's like a big civil war has just happened. And you know, some of the governments on some of these planets aren't so friendly. You know, there's oppressive governments on some. Some are more democratic and get along a little better. You know, but then we have our hero Cal, who's a human man of Earth origin, but he's never even been to Earth.
Right.
And he grew up on the streets in Mars, and he grew up in street gangs. So I just wanted to really come up with this guy who's just so disenfranchised. Because he's completely separate from his race. He's completely separate from his planet that he's you know,
his origins.
Yeah, is you know his he's just out of time, completely out of place. And you know, I just informing him, it was just all these old Paul Newman movies that I've always loved. Like he's Cool Hand Luke. He's Lou Harper. He's all these like very fringe guys that I always loved watching Paul Newman play. You know, he's kind of rootless, baseless guy, but doing his best to find meaning in life. And, you know, kind of like, you know, Professor Moriarty in that way, you know, only Cal's much more kind of every man, you know. So Cal is a guy who he grew up in street gangs, but he kind of got himself together. He joined the police force, becomes a homicide detective. Then this war breaks out and he ends up being like in the Colonial Marines kind of, you know, force. And he has like a really bad experience that we flash back to during the story. That was a formative experience to him as a young man. The war's over now. He's in the NSS security, which is basically kind of like their equivalent of like the FBI, or it's like the military and the police are kind of melded in this society. So he's kind of police, kind of a federal investigator. And he's in trouble. He's in the brig in the beginning because he's kind of got his black market. He's selling video games. And he gets pulled out of the brig and they're like, okay, you got a lot of experience on the streets in Mars, Mars Central City, the Red City. And, the police force there and all this, there's some secret talks going down there, between, a couple of the planet's ambassadors. And one of the Mercury's ambassador's daughter has gone missing. We need you to find her before everything goes sour. And then it turns out he's being set up to take a fall for something. And, he's having, the girl doesn't turn up anywhere she's supposed to be, and it just blows up into this thing where he's got to find this girl, he's got to straighten out this situation, or there's going to be genocide that happens on Neptune, you know, these political dissidents that he comes to know. And so it just ends up being huge, and can this guy with his scarred past handle it?
Right.
You know, so.
So you really enjoy putting together those mysteries, don't you?
Yeah.
Is that something like you found yourself doing in your playwriting as well and all that?
Well, yeah, you know, mystery writing kind of, I mean, that really came to me when I started getting into comics, really, you know? Like when I wrote the plays, I was writing kind of like dramedies, you know, kind of very character-driven pieces. Yeah, I don't know. I you know, Star Trek, watching Star Trek as a kid had a lot to do with it. Also, I was a huge Magnum PI fan.
Oh my gosh, I was too. Oh, I love Magnum PI.
Yeah, so Magnum and Star Trek were very important to me. And like Star Trek always involves a mystery.
Yeah.
There's always a big fantastic reveal at the end.
Yeah.
You know, and then like Magnum was, you know, I go back and look at those shows now and they hold up really in a way. The stories are really well crafted. Yeah. Like, the name is the names are flying out of my head, but the Florida novelist, John D.
The Travis McGee one?
Yeah, the Travis McGee.
Oh, God, I can't remember.
I not remember this? But I'm going to have to fact check this. But
Brian right now is on a Travis McGee run.
Oh, okay.
He can't stop.
I love his books. And
They're really great. And there's some wonderful things definitely about Florida.
Yeah, and you know, each of those Magnum episodes were like a Travis McGee story. And it's John T. McDonald.
I shouldn't know that too.
The names are all flying out of my head. But, you know, so, you know, that's how I kind of got into those type of stories. Yeah. And plus, I watched all the old Humphrey Bogart movies and all that when I was a kid. So like noir and mystery and all that was, you know, again, for me, it all ends up being about human experience, and it's all kind of a spiritual journey, like Superman and my discovery of ethics and how to live life and how to have dignity. With noir, it's kind of like it's a spiritual struggle because like you had these people, everybody was coming home after a terrible war. They're getting dumped onto these dark streets. People are trying to kill them and they don't know why. Their brother's missing. They don't know where he is. And they're trying to find him and they don't know why everybody's after him. And they don't know why everybody thinks that they're somebody else and why they're trying to kill them. Mm-hmm. It's all these like huge forces.
Right.
Bigger than you forces coming after you is a noir story. And you have to reason and figure your way through it. And yeah, it's a huge kind of spiritual struggle for me, noir.
Yeah.
And it's so that's why
it's so well done.
And I gravitate towards that.
Put it on Mars is just so fun. But like you were saying, that you're right. You can take noir and then you can take Star Trek and all that. It just comes down to good when you break down, when you do actually take the, to me, the noir out of it or the science fiction out of it and everything, it comes down to good storytelling and which can start with, you know, you can say almost all television shows now or movies now, you can relate to a Shakespeare story, you know, or to some Greek play or anything. And now we just get to have fun with them and put them in different situations and every once in a while, you know, you get to create something really new.
Yeah, everything. I mean, like young writers like always ask me, how do I come up with stories? And I always tell them, stories are out there. They're like in the air. You just got to grab them, you know? Yeah. And I always think of this scene from a great neo-noir, Heat, which is one of my favorite movies.
It's a great movie.
When De Niro goes to visit Tom Noonan to get information on this bank job, and he has all these specs and all these blueprints. He's like, how do you get this stuff? And he's like, this stuff gets beamed out everywhere. They shoot the stuff out all over the place. You just got to know how to grab it. I know how to grab it. And I always think of that. I always think of Tom Noonan sitting on that, up on that hill in LA there, in downtown LA, in a wheelchair, you know, with these blueprints. He's got all these radar dishes. And I think of him saying, yeah, I use these gigantic radar dishes to grab stuff. You got to know how to grab it, you know. And that's kind of like what writing is. There are just forces of how you tell a story. You know, it started with the Greeks and it went up to Shakespeare, like you say, and then, you know, the great pulp writers of the 20th century, you know, the great playwrights. Yeah. There are ways to tell stories. You got to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know.
I like that analogy, though, of them all being out there and you just have to grab it. I think that's true. I'm going to, because as usual, I'm so fascinated with my guests that I can talk forever, but I want to make sure.
Oh, we got to fast forward a little bit. We got to keep going here.
Yeah, we got to keep going. I want to make sure we talk about Bloodworth.
Because absolutely.
Bloodworth is you put it out digitally first, right, on Comixology.
Yeah.
And now you're putting out issues, and you've doing a Kickstarter for it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is the second Kickstarter. I've read the first one, which was really, really fun. I can't wait to actually talk about it. But the Kickstarter you're doing now is to fund the second issue?
Yeah.
Is that what that's about?
Yep.
And how long does it take for, is it different for every story, I take it, right? For one issue to get out there, between you coming up with a story, talking with your artist and everything, how long do you have to give yourself for just one?
Well, you know, in this case, it's like I'm putting this out myself and we're kickstarting it. We're doing it one at a time. So it's taking a lot of time, you know? Now, first of all, like Bloodworth is a thing, like a concept that I had struggled with for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I would write pages and pages of stuff and then throw it away and, you know, I finally, you know, I had to hone the idea down to what ends up being to me a much simpler version of what I was trying to do before. Mm-hmm. You know, so the story basically is the lead character is Special Agent Brenda Bloodworth, and it's kind of the near future.
Is that named after your wife?
It's named after my wife.
Oh, I love it. Okay, so Brenda Bloodworth.
Yeah.
I love that.
She's great. I love that.
It's name. Also wonderfully alliterative, so.
Yeah, I know, right?
In addition,
it works wonderfully. But you know, it's in the near future where she's a leader of this FBI squad that can enter people's memories to solve crimes, you know.
Thought acquisition.
Thought acquisition is the name of their unit. Their nickname is the Ghost Squad,
right?
You know, because they're scary, you mm-hmm. know, and they're completely unethical, of course. But
yeah, they are. They are legal.
Yeah, they yeah. are legal. They're yeah. completely unethical. They're illegal, but it's okay because they're doing. They're using the technology for good.
For
so
good,
that makes
exactly.
it okay.
I love that. That you know, line.
So
that,
that's yeah. that's a problem. That is part of the that's part of the society they're living in. But yeah, you know, and I wrote the whole story. I wrote all the script, and then I thought, I had an opening sequence that kind of really exposed the world, the rules mm-hmm. of the world, the rules of the technology, and kind of introduced all the characters. And so I wrote that as a short, an 11-page comic story. And then I went to Chris, who colored Red City for me, Chris Finoglio. And I'm like, okay, I can fund this short story and we can do this. And then we'll see what we can do to get the rest of the series going. Mm-hmm. And so he drew this 11-page story, did a beautiful cover for it, and I put it together as a short right. comic, and I put it up on Comixology for 99¢. It's Bloodworth issue 0.
Right.
Always knowing there would be more, but like that's the only thing that's really available commercially right now is 0 issue.
Then
you know, I spent the rest of and that came out early let's see, that was September of 2015 that finally came out at Comixology. Mm-hmm. We started it in February of 2015. We started it, and then I spent the most of that year investigating how I was going to put it out, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I decided finally to at least put that up on Comixology, and then I had settled on, okay, I'm going to kickstart the rest of it. Mm-hmm. So that came out on the 0 issue, came out September 2015, Comixology. And then it was March of this year, 2016, that we started the Kickstarter for the first full issue.
Right.
So the first full issue includes that 0 issue plus 18 new pages.
Right.
And that gets us through basically the first act of our story. Uh-huh. And so we successfully kickstarted that in March, and March through April. And then I was able to send out the books very recently. It was starting in August. I was able to start getting them out to the backers. So like those the only folks that have print copies now are Kickstarter backers.
Right.
The first issue, the first full issue is not available commercially yet. It's only
right.
available through Kickstarters.
Right.
I'm going to wait.
So the people listening should mm-hmm. contribute to the Kickstarter. I yeah. like I said, I read it really quickly. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
And I read in an interview that you did, that you called it, Bones meets Total Recall, mm-hmm. which I thought was great. It's just the same way you explained Red City, mm-hmm. you know, with LA Confidential, the Mars Noir and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with that. And it's so interesting that you say it's unethical, yet mm-hmm. we're doing it for good, because I did feel that way. I was like, you know, it's very invasive,
mm-hmm.
you know, what they're doing there. They catch a criminal and they can get inside his brain and
yeah.
see the memories that they see. And you want the murder cases to be solved. So you're rooting
yeah.
for the Ghost Squad,
mm-hmm.
right? But at the same time, you're like, well, where does it being okay to access someone's mind begin?
Mm-hmm.
And where does that end? And it's actually quite topical right now in 2016 with
yeah.
privacy and
mm-hmm.
and all that stuff. Were you aware? Is that one of the things that inspired you is how we, God, I can't think of a less gross term, basically vomit our information
mm-hmm.
out right now to
yeah.
the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get upset when the government wants access to it.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
I mean, absolutely. That happens. That's a good way of putting it. I mean, that in the world of Bloodworth, it's society is people upload memories to be on public display in city squares,
which
you
I
know?
Love. I thought yeah. that Mind Palace thing, like,
yeah.
like you can put it up on a billboard for
mm-hmm.
yeah. I thought that was really neat.
Yeah, it's like Snapchat or something.
Yeah.
Only it's
Except
actual
everybody.
Memories
yeah.
coming out of your brain.
Yeah,
you know, and people have really given up so much privacy. But then you know you got criminals that want to keep things private. So they're not uploading those memories. So that's
right.
when they got the Ghost Squad's has to go in and tap those memories.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, they can't just walk right into, you know, a memory and see everything. It's never that easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't really see, can't ever really see the guy actually committing the crime in the memory, because the guy, criminals have become more sophisticated and they know how to counter.
Are
you
they
know,
doing
how,
this yeah. through mental exercises, like training their brain not to share the memory, or are they...
They're, you know, they're masking like what they're doing in the real
right.
world,
mm-hmm.
so that when they remember it, they're not, it doesn't look like they're committing the crime. Uh-huh. It doesn't look like they're doing anything.
Right.
You know, so that's why in the opening story, there's a bank robbery and mm-hmm. Bloodworth knows one of the tellers was in on it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she goes into his memory and has to look at everything in the room. And, and she has the rest of her team has like scanned and analyzed the whole room. Yeah. And they're comparing the position of objects from 1 hour to the next. And, you know, the whole thing turns on.
Yeah, which is very, very well done. I won't give it away how they find out, you know, about the teller and everything.
Though.
But it's just like, I mean, that's how attuned to the details they have to be, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
That was really neat. You know, Danger Cat's Prophet, Red City, Moriarty, this is the first one where you've had a female as a lead character. Mm-hmm. Did you know right away Bloodworth was going to be a woman? How was it compared to writing your male characters?
Well, I mean, I had written female leads and other stuff that just mm-hmm. people hadn't seen.
Right, you know. Got it.
I wrote a novella that's actually getting in my bookstore, and uh-huh. I wrote a screenplay for that, and that was my first shot at doing like kind of a mystery thriller. It was called Elizabeth Kilbride, uh-huh. and it was kind of a Mr. Ripley-esque type story, but with a female Mr. Ripley. So I had done that before, but I had gone through some years of writing. Yeah, writing Prophet, writing Moriarty, and writing Cal. I'm like, I want to write a female lead again. Uh-huh. And you know, it's just it was a nice episode opportunity to step outside myself and do something. And it's just a lot of fun because mm-hmm. it's just it's like wearing a different costume, I guess you know. And you know, I explained this to friends, and they're like, "Oh, so you're really a drag queen? Is that what you're saying?" Yeah, I'm like, "No, it's just." It's just something different, you know, to write a female character. Mm-hmm. But then again, it's like, you know, you find the commonalities, but then you find, you know, you got to put what's different. You got to examine her experience. Anytime she's experiencing something, you got to look at it. Well, as a female, uh-huh. what problems is she going to encounter here? What type of mm-hmm. bias is going to be against her in this situation?
Do you ever search for like advice, friends, but hey, say, hey, Brenda, will you look at this?
Yeah,
read over it, and does she ever call you out? I think.
I ask Brenda all the time.
Right.
She's my arbiter, you know? Uh-huh. So, but yeah, you know, and it's good because it's, anytime you got to step outside yourself like that, you create, you're just, your sense of self-awareness meter just goes up and up and up, you know? You know, I discovered that in acting, you mm-hmm. know, self-awareness just skyrockets once you study in acting and once you're mm-hmm. doing a lot of stage and stuff like that, your self-awareness really goes up.
Right.
And then when you start writing different characters, mm-hmm. that creates even more self-awareness because you got to think about different people and what different people are going to experience, mm-hmm. different situations. And then, now writing a female character, yeah, it really helps. You know, I think of Dustin Hoffman, mm-hmm. of course, in Tootsie when he says, I've never been a better man than when I was a woman, you know?
I love it.
Yeah.
And it's one of the great lines ever.
Yeah. So, and it's just, it's because, you know, his sense of self-awareness just skyrocketed because he had to step into somebody else's shoes.
Right.
It just happened to be that it was a female's shoes, you know?
Right.
It could have been, you know, it could have been a different class. It could have been something like that. But he happened to be in a female's shoes. And mm-hmm. wow, the lessons he learned when he was in a female's shoes. So,
exactly.
You know, as a writer, you know, I experiencing that. Now I have several projects now nobody's seen yet, but I have several projects now. Mm-hmm. Most new projects I come up with are female leads right now.
Well, that's great. And Brenda Bloodworth is, you know, I love that she's strong and so conflicted, which is, I think, kind of a theme with all your lead characters. There's a lot of strength in all of them and a lot of conflict. But I think as a writer, the base of every good writing and good storytelling is conflict and everything. But mm-hmm. There is a sense of damage
mm-hmm. yeah.
to them. And what do you think? Is it the human story that attracts you to mm-hmm. writing about damage?
Because, you know, you want to write exciting, fun detective stories, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. but we can't just see Brenda kicking a door, Brenda catch the bad guy, Brenda this, mm-hmm. that. What's Brenda processing? What's she going through when she's doing this? You know, what's her inner story?
What has made her up to this point?
Yeah. And this is something you learn acting, you know, it's like you look at the words on the page, but you have to come up with your story mm-hmm. that's under the page. And mm-hmm. so when you're writing the words on the page, you want to gift her that as much as you can.
I tell you, I say this all the time, and I can always, I think I can always tell, like, especially when I'm watching a movie or a TV show, I'm like, the guy who wrote this or the woman who wrote this was an actor. Like, I can always tell that in my husband's work. My husband, you know, but for those of you who don't, is a television writer. And all his characters have such big character development. You know who they are right away.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you're talking about. And I think something about training as an actor when you you know what's important.
Yeah.
So important to who that person is, it really, really comes through.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah.
You've got that down. You know it. It's not your first rodeo. You know what you're doing. But like I said, I really enjoyed the first issue of Bloodworth. I can't read the second. Let's tell everyone where we can find the Kickstarter.
All right. Well, so it's called simply Bloodworth issue number 2. Mm-hmm. It's on Kickstarter right now. Or you can search for Bloodworth. You can search for Bloodworth issue 2. You can search for my name, Daniel Corey, Corey. Yeah.
And it'll be up on if you're listening on iTunes, you can go to Geek Girl Authority and look up this episode of Neil Before Odd. I'll have all the information there too.
Yeah. And it's we're just got to raise $3,500, you know, to get the funds together. And It's mostly paying the artists is what I'm doing with the money, because that's one of the things in Kickstarter. You got to tell everybody what you're using the money for.
Yeah.
I'm paying the artists, and then the rest of it is to create for the printing and to mail everything.
Right.
You know, so it's I'm going very bare bones on this and raising the minimum amount I need to get this issue done. And we're doing one issue at a time because, you know, smaller campaigns have a greater chance of being successful, you know. So we're on day 2 right now. As I walked into your place here, we were 51% funded.
Great.
Yeah. So, and that's to encourage people to you know, hey guys, you're going to be on a winning team.
Yeah, exactly.
So go ahead and pledge. Don't wait. Don't say, wait. Oh, they're successful. They're going
to
be fine.
No, keep going, because that can only lead to more work and more output.
Yes.
For you to do, because this story definitely has legs. Which brings me, I want to talk to you real quick about new media. I think we've got some time. You got a couple minutes. New media, because, you know, your stuff is up on Comixology. Mm-hmm. Issue number 1 is only available to the Kickstarter members, but in the future, you said issue 0's on Comixology. Are you hoping to get all of Bloodworth on there? So, Moriarty's on there, Red City's on there.
Yeah, I mean, everything's on there. Like Danger Cat's Prophet is on there. Everything that you do through Image goes to Comixology. Yeah. So all of Moriarty and all of Red City are on there.
Is that process a lot different? Is it very difficult to get it up digitally?
No.
Or did Image take care of that for you? Is it just an issue of scanning and then they have like some kind of algorithm that puts it together for you?
Well, it's not hard to get the stuff to Comixology. No.
Yeah.
Image stuff, they do take care of all that. But like everything's digital, you know, so you don't give Image pages, you give them a PDF on their FTP.
Right.
So then they submit all that to Comixology. Comixology goes through, they have people that go through and do the guided view stuff, and they kind of encode everything.
Right.
And they set all that up. And so Image takes care of that when I do an Image stuff, Image book. But when I do my own stuff for Danger Cat, I just send it to them, and you know, I send them the completed files, and then they set it up. You know, it might take 2 months or something like that.
Right.
You know, but they'll get it up. So yeah, all of Bloodworth will eventually be available there.
In looking at how Moriarty or Red City's been received as far as digital downloads and actual hard copy issues, do you see people going more towards digital now? Because comics is such an interesting thing to me, since. There's the art that's involved. There's something tactile about reading a comic book. So I'm curious how it's going over to the digital. How it's going over?
Yeah, well, it's just with just like with the book market, it's like everything is finding a way to coexist.
Right.
You know. So you know, a lot of people thought that the digital, like Comixology and all that, would destroy the direct market, and it has not. You know. But it's also a major force in the universe now.
Yeah.
Comixology and Amazon. And digital comics are a thing.
Yeah.
So they found a way to coexist. They, you know, they cannibalize each other, obviously. I'm not an expert on all the numbers, but you know, I'm glad it's out there, because it's zero overhead for me. You know what I mean?
Because right.
Working at my level, even like when I put out a book through Image, it's like the cost of printing and distribution, all that is massive. So if you the digital sales can offset that,
yeah,
and it can sell forever because shop's not going to sell out of it.
Well, it certainly changed, as far as novels, it changed people's careers. I mean, people were able to self-publish and self-fund. Mm-hmm. And, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Hugh Howey. He's, mm-hmm. I think you'd love his book. He's got a bunch of books out there, but he has a book series called Wool. Mm-hmm. It's a dystopian book. And he's like one of the first major successful self-publishers out there that was able to retain all his rights and everything like that.
Yeah.
And he's doing it full time now,
that's wonderful.
Which he wasn't before. And it's just amazing what it can do for people. Mm. But also, what's your take, real quick? I keep saying real quick. See, I just want to talk forever. on virtual reality, because mm-hmm. earlier this year you were named a top influencer in virtual reality.
Weird.
Yeah, that was that a surprise to you?
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
But for something that you're doing with Moriarty, so mm-hmm. two things. One, you're looking into that technology as well, mm-hmm. because that's coming quicker than we can, it's already here.
Mm-hmm.
And how hard was that to put together and work on?
Well, It took a lot of work, but I mean, I don't actually design the technology myself.
Of course,
what I do is what I did was trying to knock on doors and pitch it to everybody.
Uh-huh.
It was just like going and trying to pitch a comic book again.
Right.
It was like I did have the slight advantage of saying, hey, I have established IP with a Sherlock Holmes universe leading character and published by Image Comics, the home of The Walking Dead. So I had that on my side this time.
In your back pocket,
yes.
Which is great,
right? So, but I hooked up with this group. They're this company called the Transmedia Group. They're in Sydney, Australia. I met them at the VRLA show earlier mm-hmm. this year. I had been pitching it for about a year, year and a half, or at least trying to get people to listen, but nobody was quite interested. And they didn't understand. Nobody really was connecting to VR comic book.
Right.
But these guys did, And they put together a prototype for WonderCon, and. Yeah, it turned out really amazing because we put
amazing.
Our heads together. It was like, what would a VR comic book be?
Uh-huh.
And so we chose to start with this story called Moriarty Endgame, which is a 10-page short story that Anthony and I did, which actually was at the printed in Red City as a mm-hmm. bonus feature and later released as a standalone on Comixology. So that came out on Comixology in February 2015. And it's a 10-page story that has – it's in a tech-laden future – with Professor Moriarty has an army of airships and Sherlock Holmes has an army of mech warriors and London is like leveled and in ruins. And, but there's still like, it's still a battle of wits and of minds, And, they really liked that story. And so they're making a virtual reality comic book out of it. And, they had the most recent edition of VRLA, I think it was in August here, and they were back here and they had done a build for the HTC Vive that was, and it was like the first, I want to say it was probably about the first four or five pages of the story. Each you're inside a panel of a comic book. Each scene,
That's
so
amazing.
You start off on the deck of Moriarty's ship, and you see actual art lifted off the comic pages, placed into this virtual 360 environment with word balloons, and with the Vive is room scaled, so you can walk around inside the virtual environment.
That's so
you can
fascinating.
Walk right up to the comic bubble. You can walk right up to Professor Moriarty's face and look at him, and in a 3D space as if he's like really there. It's
so
amazing.
Curious to see where that technology will be like 5 years from now, even 2 years from now, because that sounds absolutely fascinating. You're talking about airships versus mechs and stuff like that. I'm like, I want to be an observer. I don't want to be caught up in it.
Right.
I want to be.
But you feel caught up
observer.
In it in this
VR
comic, man. Yeah. You're like in the middle of it.
That's amazing.
When he jumps out of that airship, you're standing in the middle of the air watching him jump out of this airship. And you look down and it's thousands of feet down.
That would probably. It's scary.
They put a little platform under you mm-hmm. So that you can stand on the platform so you don't get too dizzy.
But
you can walk off
thing.
The platform and like be like a Looney Tunes character. You know what I mean? and look thousands of feet below you. But those guys are doing a wonderful job. So I'm hoping that's going to be available early 2017. We'll see.
Yeah, that would I can't wait. Let us know so we can definitely put that up. Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming over to my house and talking to me.
I loved catching up.
Yeah, this is. I said before we pressed record that this was going to be Dan and I's catch-up session about the last decade, which is awesome. So once again, please visit the Kickstarter for Bloodworth issue 2. Support that issue. It's like I said, it's got legs. It's awesome. Thank you again for being here, and thanks for kneeling the whole time. That was really nice of you.
I know my knees are sore.
Go ahead and get up. I should have given you a pillow. I didn't even think about that.
Supplicants, you may now rise. The merciful Odd has chosen to spare you. Please exit the internet to your left.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.